vivo qualitative data analysis software empowers researchers around the world to discover rich insights within their qualitative data. This podcast gives you unique insights into the methods, the processes, and the passions of researchers. Welcome to the InVivo podcast, Between the Data.
Thanks for joining us today. I'm Stacey Penna, the Engagement and Enablement Director at Lumavero. Today's podcast is with Dr. Katie Brown Johnson, who works at the Evaluation Sciences Unit, Division of Primary Care and Population Health at Stanford University School of Medicine. We will be discussing her research article, The Presence 5 for Racial Justice Framework for Anti-Racist Communication with Black Patients, published in Health Services Research. So welcome, Katie.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me, Stacey.
What was the objective of the study that we just mentioned?
Yeah, so the objective of the study, we had done Presence 5, which was really with Donna Zolman and Abraham Verghese at Stanford. That was really focused on humanism in medicine and on connecting patients and clinicians, really helping clinicians be present. So it's like clinician presence with patients. And then we were already in the process of, we had actually just secured funding to extend our work, particularly to lower resource settings. The funding for extending our work came through the weekend that George Floyd was murdered. And our team sat down and said that next week, our team really had a series of conversations. We have this funding. We have a mandate to expand or extend Presence 5 to areas of need. And we really refocused on specifically on supporting Black patients and supporting clinicians in providing excellent care for Black patients. And so that was kind of our mandate for the work, is to use the methods that we'd used in Presence 5 to build out a tool for clinicians that would support them in providing excellent and equitable care for Black patients.
So then, you know, can you explain the Presence 5 for Racial Justice, which you talked about, P5RJ framework?
Sure. It's meant to be a relatively straightforward, it's design thinking infused. And so it's meant to be a deceptively straightforward framework that provides clinicians a framework of things that they can do that will really support Black patients. We have five. PLACE is the acronym, prepare. So that's about being ready. That's about making sure that the clinic itself is warm and inviting. Listen, and we'll talk more about the patient voice and how important listening is. Agree on what matters most is really about having explicit conversations about patient goals and coming really agenda setting. Connect with the patient story is about making a human connection with the patient that's outside of their clinical needs. And then exploring emotional cues is the E, and is really about making space for emotion and being aware of how emotions impact a patient-clinician interaction. As far as our methodology is concerned, we started off with a literature review to look at best practices and current problematic gaps in terms of patient care for Black patients, and followed that with a mixture. And these were, it's exciting because it's overlapping qualitative methods. So we pulled together a patient and clinician community advisory board. It's a virtual community advisory board, which at the time wasn't being done all that much. You know, at this point, people have got that down pat, which is great. But that allowed us to have a national advisory board, a community advisory board, which was exciting. We conducted Presence 5 for Racial Justice circles, which were discussion groups with clinicians, asking them about where they saw these practices coming up and what gaps they saw in being able to best support their Black patients. And then we did a suite of interviews, two suites of interviews. One, and this is really design thinking, one that was with analogous experts. So we interviewed people, mostly Black professionals, about how they supported professionals, Black professionals out in the world. Outside, the analogous piece for design thinking is about it being outside of the domain, seeing what there is in a near adjacent domain that you can apply. And then the sort of keystone of everything was a series of in-depth interviews with patients across the country, Black patients across the country, in terms of their experiences, positive and negative, with individual clinicians and with the healthcare system.
How many interviews did you end up doing? Because it sounds like you have a lot of data there.
With a lot of data. So we interviewed 35 Black patients, 40 professionals, and then our clinicians involved, there were about 24 clinicians involved. I think overall it was more than 100 people. Mm-hmm. Here we go, 112 participants, mm-hmm. including the community advisory board, the two different interview groups, and the clinician circles, which, you know, you could also frame those as focus groups.
How were your participants recruited?
Number one, we had a huge and really important team. Our group really focuses on team science, you know, with Dr. Zulman as our PI and me kind of directing the ship. We really focus on team science. So we had a lot of people involved. And part of our strategy was to create partnerships with different clinics across the country. And that was really facilitated some by network, some by word of mouth. And then in at least two cases, it was really facilitated by our team. So who did our team know? Again, this being, we sort of started the summer of 2020. So kind of at the beginning of being able to easily include people on our team from across the country. And that was sort of a new thing. And so we partnered with a clinic in Leeds, Alabama, with a clinic in Memphis, one in Rochester, New York, and then one in Oakland, California. That kind of work is, it takes time to build the partnerships, obviously, and it takes effort. And I would extend this to the community advisory board as well. Like it's a lot of time being in touch with people. I think with our underlying focus really being about humanism in medicine, it felt like a good alignment of our values and our time to be building partnerships and sustaining partnerships, both with patients and with clinicians. And it's effortful. It's not like you say, awesome, we're partnered, go recruit people. I mean, you can say that, but then you say a lot of other things too.
Have you been able to sustain those relationships over time?
We have sustained those relationships over time. I would say we're in a little bit of a lull with those partnerships in that there's not active work that's happening. When you start to talk about partnerships, when you start to talk about community advisory board, the elephant in the room is funding to sustain those efforts. And I think we did a good job of putting a fair number of, our team did a very good job putting together resources to continue to sustain those efforts, but there's less of a mechanism in grant and in philanthropic funding to sustain partnerships over the long haul, which I think is a gap and a problem for, especially as we do more patient integration, especially as we have to, like that's a must, like patient integration has to happen in research, especially in work like this. You know, we could continue to gather together, but that, you know, we could continue to convene the community advisory board, but that also seems problematic if we don't have any resources to support the time that people are putting in and the effort. We have close relationships. We'd be happy to warm them up at any point in time. And at this moment, we're at a bit of a pause with those because there's not an active project in that space.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, thank you for sharing that. That was interesting.
This podcast is sponsored by LumaVero,
developers of InVivo and other software designed by and for data experts to illuminate powerful new insights that help customers make decisions with confidence. If you're looking for a better way to collaborate and share InVivo projects with your colleagues or team, try using InVivo Collaboration Cloud with the 14-day trial.
You've talked about your team. Can you talk about who was on your team and how you created the team?
We had a team at Stanford, staff and faculty involved at Stanford. And then we actually ended up for, I think this was the second or third year that we had summer students through a program at Stanford that's now the REACH program. And this brought students to Stanford from historically Black medical colleges to partner with researchers for summer scholarship opportunities. And so we had some students that joined through that, and at least a couple of those students were able to stay on with us. They had a little bit of extra time and we were able to continue funding them. We got some additional funding to post for scholar positions. And so we actually had a fantastic PhD. Joy Cox was my co-author, super strong co-author. She's moved into industry at this point. She joined the team as a scholar with us and stayed on. We had research assistants that had joined when we were recruiting locally for another study in diverse settings, and they stayed on with us. So, and then we had, you know, our team of partners. So we've got a slide somewhere I could share. Wait, it was very much a team effort, and everybody, I think it was a wonderful coming together, and we did experience firsthand some of what happens with a big and a diverse team. You slow down, you define your terms, you take extra time to make sure everybody's on the same page. I actually was really excited about the opportunities within Zoom in a meeting for back channel feedback. So there were, you know, a couple more junior folks that I would kind of check in with every meeting live and say like, hey, what are you thinking? I know you're thinking something exciting. Let's get it out in the open because it's super important for you to have a voice in all of this.
Thank you. That was a large team.
It's a really large
team. A lot of balls to juggle there.
Yeah, a really large team. And I think that's definitely part of how we had the power to be able to do the various aspects of the study and also the various modalities that we use, the focus groups, the interviews, and the different foci also enabled us to have major leadership in those individual pieces that I think is super important. In a big team, you can end up with serious contributors not being front and center. And so, for instance, Dr. Megha Shankar really led the analogous interviews and has a publication out about that. There's room in a big project, if you set it upright, for people to lead and really have significant chunks of work that are their own in addition to the overall product.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah. So, you know, it was one project, people had ownership of different parts, and then they were able to maybe do more writing or publications in that area.
Yes, exactly. Oh. Yeah.
How did you analyze all that data?
Right. So we used online distributed qualitative software to analyze, super important so that everybody could have access kind of at the same time. We were in different time zones. And then we used a consensus-based approach. So consensus coding. Again, this was with a large team. Our team of coders was not quite as large as that. And our team of coders varied across the different data sets. And so we had off and on a weekly meeting. So we would probably have like 3 months, a quarter, weekly meetings for coding with 5 to 7 coders where we met and discussed what we were seeing, what was coming up, what the emergent codes were. So we were always coding both for the Presence 5 framework, the PLACE And that, again, is prepare, listen, agree on what matters, connect with the patient's story, and explore emotional cues. So we were always coding for that, as well as emergent themes. An example of an emergent theme from the analogous interviews was this concept of grace and really giving people the benefit of the doubt in a professional situation. And, you know, the main things that I emphasized in, and this was 2 years of qualitative coding, a quarter, it wasn't as structured as this, but like a quarter on, a quarter off, a quarter on, a quarter off, you emphasize disagreement. That part is actually consensus, sounds like you're moving towards where everybody agrees. And that's the important part. That's not the important part for me. The best research comes out of people bringing out disagreements, bringing out and really tackling viewpoints that are not the standard, that's not what everybody else is thinking. There's some good psychology literature that products are better when people emphasize disagreement, obviously collegial disagreement, but emphasize disagreement and really work to not shut down minority viewpoints, work to really fully understand those and understand together how it all fits together. So that's where you get once a week conversations. The whole point is to pull up what we're disagreeing about, what we're not seeing as the same, so that we eventually do come out with a consensus about what exploring emotional cues looks like. And we did some version of that process for each of the different data pieces. It depended. So we didn't do transcripts for the community advisory board. We more had feedback from them. So we were looking at the feedback and integrating the feedback. We did that approach pretty rigorously for both of the interview data sets. And then for the focus groups, the Presence 5 for racial justice circles, we more emphasized for those, the place, the actual practices and what practices were working, as well as barriers and facilitators. And then combing through all of that, so once we had everything analyzed, it's still hard to get your head wrapped around it. As I really sat down, you know, with the team to write, in addition to the themes that we talked about and the organized excerpts, by the time I was writing, I really sat back down and literally printed out all of our patient interviews. I really wanted to emphasize the patient interviews. I printed them all out and read them like a book just to center myself back in the patient voice. We wanted to make sure it was really front and center. And then also just to, you know, center myself in like what the gestalt was, because we'd really been in the analysis weeds for a long time. And the synthesis piece of pulling that all back together was non-trivial and at a different scale than projects, other projects that I've done.
So I'm curious, because to have, like, I like that to be more productive, you have to have disagreement, right? Like you said, professional disagreement. So how did you set up, I guess, a culture or people feeling safe enough? Because you had students, you had people in the academic hierarchy, you know, it sounds like different levels. Is there something that you found worked or helped you?
Yeah, definitely. I was pretty intentional about the team science approach. You know, there's some good team science best practices. I'm a big fan of icebreakers. Mm-hmm. There is solid evidence behind the efficacy of icebreakers. You know, people are like, icebreakers, but they're in a team environment. They're really important. I think we settled into, you know, more of like a rose and a thorn. What's going on with you? What are you proud of? What did you do that you were proud of in the last week? What's something that you saw somebody else in this team do that you want to shout out? What kudo do you want to give? And we would start off most of our meetings like that. We also intentionally rotated who was like in charge or facilitating. And so that's going to do some for leveling the hierarchy. I was quite intentional about it, honestly. And I didn't rely on just me to be intentional. Honestly, I used my spidey sense as well. So And I can remember in particular, there was one meeting that I was like, things are off. And I ended up on the phone with people throughout the afternoon, just checking in. Mm-hmm. Hey, I actually ended up using a piece of Presence 5. So for listen, one of the pieces of evidence broadly, not specific to Black patients, is to ask, well, this is sort of listen and agree, to ask, is there something else? You know, is there something else you want to talk about? Versus, is there anything else? I'm a linguist, so I probably get stuck on this. So like, something is assuming that there is something else. And the anything is assuming that there's not. I remember one day in particular where I'd had an hour-long conversation with a colleague. And I just said, you know, is there something else? And then there was really something else that we needed to discuss. Mm-hmm. So some of it is just time, you know, really making the time to connect with people and connect in a real and a deep way. Again, like a lot of it is Presence 5.
Connect
in a real and a deep way outside of medicine, outside of work. Who are the people that are on your team?
No, that's great. Thank you. That was very interesting.
We'll take a quick break from the episode. You can find Dr. Brown Johnson's work by visiting her profile at Stanford University with the URL profiles.stanford.edu/Katie Brown Johnson, C-A-T-I Brown Johnson.
What were the results of the study?
In the weeds, there are lots of specific things. I was really excited, again, when I went and looked sort of at the large gestalt, that for patients, for Black patients, the major thing is listening. That is what patients need. And the, you know, the quotes we got around that were really informative. I never had somebody sit down and just listen to me. All I want is for my doctor to listen, and not just listen, but deep listening. Listen with the connection as well. So I'll jump straight to listen, because I was really interested, you know, in looking at our results, that the core of interpersonally supporting Black patients is as fundamental as listening and listening well. And then there are pieces around making sure that there are supports in place for people who need various ancillary support. I think that one of the interesting strategies that we saw was a recommendation for a physician to get in touch with a physician that they're referring a Black patient to say, I'm sending you this patient, basically more of a warm handoff. And also the physicians vetting the people that they are sending their patient, referring their patients to, because there's such a sense of earned medical mistrust. And I call it earned on purpose, because the mistrust in the Black community of medical establishment is something that the medical establishment has, that they've earned. And just as a evidence of that, most of our interviews with patients brought up the Tuskegee experiments, the improper treatment of Tuskegee airmen. And these are individuals who were supposedly treated for syphilis and were actually given syphilis and then not attended to appropriately, not treated. And it was allowed to, I mean, it's an awful, awful, awful chapter in medicine's history that all of our patients wanted to talk about. That's definitely kind of in the back of everybody's mind.
With the listening, I just was at a conference, and one of the presenters, when they were doing interviews, she's a Black woman, she was interviewing Black women, and she found it was very important to pause and let people answer, like, don't just jump to the next question. Did you find that too? Were there?
Yes. This this is where I'm emphasizing some of the novel stuff, some of the new stuff with Presence 5 for Racial Justice. Presence 5 for Racial Justice is built on Presence 5. physicians interrupt patients, I think it's like every 7 to 11 seconds. It's very quick. And so, yes, just not interrupting as a major piece. I think we didn't hear about it so much as a pause as we heard about it in terms of listening until someone was done talking. I really like the pause, actually. And I think that that's probably another really nice way to go at it, is just to wait. The idea being, as a physician, just don't open your mouth for a little bit. Just wait and listen. And listen, and this is hard for physicians, listen without trying to put all of the pieces together immediately.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I could see that being tough. Because they're trained to do that. My next question is, what recommendations do you have for clinicians' interpersonal practices, like versus institutional practices? Because you talked about both.
Yeah. Yeah. We really emphasize the interpersonal and also understand that that's a major limitation. There's the systemic issues of racism in healthcare are real. We've sort of folded that in with Prepare for Presence 5 for Racial Justice, in recommending that physicians stay up to date on the literature, for example, around race-adjusted calculators. And I don't have a good example because I'm not a physician and I probably would say all the words wrong, but there are definitely some race-adjusted calculators that exist where you put in what the numbers are for blood pressure. Again, bad example because I'm not a physician. For blood pressure for a Black patient and for a white patient, and you get different recommendations for treatment for the same number because of historical race adjustments that are outdated, regardless of how they got into place. And these are still making an impact in terms of how people get recommended for surgery, for instance, whether Black patients have access to various treatments. That's kind of a systems piece. I would say also, you know, at the local systems level, Presence 5 for Racial Justice is available online. You know, we have a website, we have this publication, we have free continuing medical education through Stanford website, videos and interactive content, and that stuff that people could do with their clinics over lunch, stuff that people could do by themselves. This didn't get into the paper, but I was always interested in a clinic audit where you might just go in and see what colors and abilities and what's the diversity of the faces that are on the walls that are represented in your clinic that your staff are, and just be mindful of what you might want to emphasize, how you might signal your clinic is a safe place. We definitely heard clinicians saying that their clinics had put up signs to let people know this is a safe place for you. You're welcome here. Is that helpful?
Yeah, definitely. So my last question is, what's one piece of advice you would give researchers working across multiple institutions and sites?
I would say, working across multiple institutions and sites, there's one sort of broad answer and one really technical answer. And the technical answer is, like, mind your P's and Q's. Working across institutions, generally it involves lawyers, and that's the get them involved early, know them, make them part of your team, and look for alternative ways to work together that maybe, you know, there's usually more than one way to go to approach a partnership. So I would say that on the side of, like, what can really hinder a study and did not in our case is some of the procedural, some of the bureaucratic partnership issues. And then I would say on a broader standpoint, for partnerships and not just partnerships with particular institutions, but also communities, you've got to have inside stakeholders at the table. So we were, like I said, we were in close communication with some of the clinics that we partnered with. We really made an effort to include diverse participants as part of our team to include and emphasize support of our Black colleagues within our team to really build people up and give people the opportunity to, again, to have veto power, have disagreement power, not just in terms of coding, but also in terms of like, how are we setting this up? How are we approaching this project? And at a fundamental level, I think the ideal is really research that is led by the community. We've been able to do that only in terms of partnership. I'm not Black. I really saw myself as the person that was shepherding this across the finish line, felt a fair amount of pressure to make sure I was getting it right in terms of that. And then I was also building people up and giving people as much credit and as much ownership as we could. We included one patient on our publication as a co-author. It's a mix of making sure that you are including people from your partnerships, thinking outside of the box about how you can partner, and then making sure that the bureaucratic stuff is really taken care of.
Thank you, Katie, for talking with us, and thanks for those tuning in. Listeners, if you learn more about this racial justice framework, we'd appreciate your support by rating and subscribing to the Inviva podcast. This helps us to share these amazing narratives with the research community. So thank you, Katie.
Thank you so much, Stacey. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for joining us for Between the Data. If you enjoyed this podcast and want to hear more about Invivo podcasts and community events, please visit go.invivobyqsr.com/community or email me, Stacey Penna, at s.penna, P-E-N-N-A, at qsrinternational.com.